Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist and political prisoner. His commentaries can be found at prisonradio.org. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have the words green or renewable in them. But then when you dig into them more deeply, it turns out that not only are they a waste of precious time, but they actually are climate solutions that are worse for the climate. It's like chasing chimeras, a beast from Greek mythology, which sounds fabulous, but ends up to be a fanciful illusion.
Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a new documentary by veteran producer Barbara Bernstein, premieres on Locus Focus Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m. Tune into Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or 91.9 FM Hood River, or anywhere in the world streaming online at kboo.fm. That's Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
Little Jimmy's gone away out on the back street, out of the window to the falling rain, right on time, right on time.
Good evening, here we are again. Happy to be here with our wonderful, another wonderful guest. But before that, we are going to ask, as we always do every other Friday, for your collaboration, generosity, and your commitment to our station. This time, we want to you to help us to keep the end of the year campaign. And we have a special 1-1 match of $20,000. What I am sure that we can do it, and because we have so many nice donors that will be very happy to collaborate with this wonderful station that give a lot of opportunity to artists and general issues that are important to our community. Tonight we have Christopher Luna, we were talking about Italy, so I was ready to speak a little bit of Spanish and Italian, but no. He is Christopher Luna, and we are very happy. Hola, hola. And he's going to introduce himself to all of us. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me on the program. I'm a poet, an editor, a creative writing teacher. I've been in the Northwest for 20 or so years, a lifelong New Yorker, and I'm the host of the Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic in Vancouver, Washington, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary. And I really enjoy helping writers and building community in Vancouver and elsewhere. We have a lot of friends in Portland as well.
Great. As you can see, he's a man of the Renaissance. He has done and he's doing still a lot of things, many artistic talent that he will share tonight with us. I am very, very happy. And I would like to know, since when have you been writing?
I began writing when I was about 11 years old. I started writing fiction. The two writers who really made me excited about writing at that time were John Irving and Stephen King. So the first writing that I did was, you know, horror, fantasy, short fiction. And then in my 20s, I read Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass and Allen Ginsberg's collected poems, and that determined the course of the rest of my life. I was sort of selected by poetry at that point and pulled by the lapels into my poetic future by reading those two books when I was in college.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible how something so simple, because when we look at the book, look like a simple thing, like it's easy to do, can change our life? Because if I understood correctly, this is what it happened to you. This writer and books change your life in some way or direct your life in some particular direction, don't you think?
Yes. Yes, in the back of Allen Ginsberg's book was a glossary of certain terms. And one of the things that was mentioned there was the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, which is a school that Allen Ginsberg founded with the poets Diane DePrima and Anne Waldman in 1974. So I found that interesting, and I went out in 1994 for a week-long tribute to Allen Ginsberg, and that alone would have changed the rest of my life. But I also returned a few years later in 97, and that time that I spent there at Naropa University from 97 to 99 definitely changed my life or determined a lot of what would come later, including the teaching. I began teaching around 98. I was taught by someone named Jack Collum. He's no longer with us. A lot of my teachers there are no longer with us, but he taught several generations of people to design writing workshops for the community and to go out into the community and teach them. So I hadn't planned to teach so soon, but I actually began teaching before my graduate studies were finished.
Nice. And as I understand, you also create and teach a workshop. You offer workshop to the community. And some of them, they're not only autobiographical or about ourselves or our writing. It's also about growth, self-growth.
Yes.
And how that goes, how we relate our self-doubt as a writer, as a poet, as an artist, as a human being, with something so important to us and at the same time that is difficult to deal when you are in that period of your life or in that moment where you feel a lot of self-doubt about your craft.
Yes.
Give us some advice, all right?
I feel like I lead workshops in poetry and memoir.
Yes.
The issues for all writers and all creative people are very similar. I think that self-doubt is really unavoidable and essential to the creative writing process. And so I talk to writers about trying to believe in yourself as you're doing the work. All writers, every time you share something of yourself, you're making yourself vulnerable. I think all writers and creative people want their work to be good. So there's a big question of, is this good or not? And so in the workshops, a lot of it is kind of just helping people to relax enough to believe in themselves and believe in how unique they are as individuals, so that even if they may be beginners to writing, I tell them, lean hard into what makes you who you are, and the skills will come from practice and repetition over time, and certainly from reading. We encourage a lot of reading in those workshops as well. But yeah, I think self-doubt, you can't get rid of it. You just work through it, and I actually think it drives self-doubt and perpetual dissatisfaction drive us to remain motivated as creative people. They're very important. They might be difficult to deal with, but they're essential, and you really can't escape either one. You know.
So. I agree, but also censorship. That is not exactly the same than self-doubt. In my case, was a lot of censorship, and one teacher at U of O told me once, I don't want to read anything about somebody else. I want to read what you have to write about yourself. And then I realized how much censorship it was in me, and that I didn't want to talk about it or to write about it. But as I mentioned to you before, this program we try to give the opportunity to our audience to express themselves in a sentence, in a poem, and whatever, in a way that they can feel that they are sharing their emotion, their stories. It's exactly what you do with your student, isn't it? In your memoir workshop.
Yes, and I think the belief in self is so important, because there really isn't any guarantee that there's anyone else who is going to care. You know, I don't mean that in a negative way.
Yes.
I mean that I feel like the best artists and the best writers, we're our first audience and our best audience for our work because of how well we know ourselves. So if you believe in what you're doing, if you believe that what you're doing has value, then you can also imagine that the stories might have value for someone else. And I say you work from a belief in that, and it's driven in a lot of ways by you write the things that would interest you or excite you. And it turns out that all the great artists, all the iconic artists, that's what they did. So it's really about not censoring yourself and really just telling the stories that you have to tell and speaking the truth that you need to speak, and believing that that's inherently valuable.
And I think that is a lesson that we have learned from Proust, for example, and many other writers, that they were rejected at the beginning of their career, and they persisted even when he was sick. He was finishing his masterpiece, and many other. Okay, I will remind our audience, our phone number is 503-231-8187. You are welcome to call and to ask Christopher whatever do you want to ask or make a comment, but now we are going to listen to him. Okay, tell us, what are you going to read?
I'm going to read a recent poem that's called In Need of a New Ritual.
Oh, beautiful title.
In Need of a New Ritual. This river is all periphery, a perspective not accorded to me. Let these particles drift into me, disturbing the most sensitive follicles. Just beyond the entrance ways, allergic to the given ways, can I find a way to forgive myself for the time wasted? My willful ignorance, a habit as impossible to kick as the taste for sugar. Meet me in the open places, the emptiness between here and elsewhere. Help me forge a new relationship with the ancient injuries I struggle to access. I can almost see you peer back at me from the crone tree, that space a portal to the mystery of me, my inherent negative capability.
How long it take you to write a poem of that kind, for example?
Well, this came out of a very specific experience.
There's
a place in Ridgefield, Washington called Plasnewid Farm.
Yeah.
And I was invited there to lead workshops, but they do workshops with painters and many different kinds of people. It's a very beautiful environment. And I asked Abby Brathwaite, who is one of the owners of the farm and the leader of the Plasnewid Arts Initiative, to, you know, lead us on a hike and a walk. And one of the places that she took us to was to this tree. And I had an encounter as I stared at this tree. And I'll be honest with you, I don't always write at the same time as my writing students when they're writing. Sometimes I'm getting prepared for things we're going to do or thinking about other things, always related to the workshop, but I don't always, you know, I reserve the right to not do it at the same time. But it's so inspiring to be out there on the farm, and I just had to write about this tree.
Beautiful. That has a big impact on you. I can feel that.
It did.
And that is the reason, because it was already inside of you. So when you saw it, you said, you felt that this is it. I have to do it.
You had to. Yes.
Great. Okay. What else?
Okay.
Yeah. Take advantage.
Here's a poem from my book, Message from the Vessel in a Dream, which came out just at the end of 2018 from Flowstone Press.
Yeah.
This is about how I feel about missing my home in New York. Best laid
what
plans.
What place in New York, by the way?
Oh, well, I grew up on Long Island. This poem, I think, is probably inspired a little bit more by New York City than Long Island, though.
Yes. Okay.
Best laid plans. When I finally make it back to my birthplace, what will remain of what I once loved? Will I recognize the place? Who will be around? Will they take me in? Will it be too late? All my family and friends dead or moved on? Will the rhythm of the street be familiar, or will it be like enduring a lame cover of an indelible classic like Stairway to Heaven? How much of what I remember is accurate? How will I separate truth from myth? New York City is Valhalla, looms taller in my heart's memory than the Twin Towers. Bedrock, boombox, sitting with the bleacher bums at the house that Ruth built. Melancholy, syncopation, straight talk, efficiency, cacophony, chaos. Beauty so hardcore, it tears at your insides. Will the city still have that swing? Will I have strength enough to strut down those streets again? Or will I collapse onto the sidewalk, shaking my cane at the sky?
Full of homesick and nostalgia.
Yes.
And in some way, seems to me that you were or are feeling that some part of you feel as an immigrant. Am I right or nothing to do?
Well, I would say the culture of the Northwest versus the East Coast is different enough that, and America is large enough.
Yes.
I mean, it feels, I imagine, a lot like the immigrant experience. And of course, we live in a country of immigrants, and my parents and grandparents were immigrants. You know, so there's that. I feel like I might as well have been dropped into a foreign country when I found myself here in the Northwest. And I came out at the end of 2001, and just a month after the terrorist attacks in New York. And it really felt like bad timing for me in terms of everything. But one thing was, I felt very sad about leaving the city at that time. I was living in Queens at the time, and really enjoyed that. Found myself coming
out
this way.
But that is a feeling that I rescue from the first reading. I mean, that the nostalgia, the homesick, the what is left. And last time, another poet from Arabia, Jerusalem, he was here, and we spoke a lot about the nostalgia and the homesick that we feel when we immigrate. Even if you immigrate from another place that is in your country, but it's a completely different culture, so it's almost like it's another country.
Well, places have energy, and I'm really inspired by the energy of New York. And I found that when I was commuting by subway, for example, that I really just needed to have a notebook and a pen and have my eyes and ears open, and the poems appeared to me. You know, I don't mean to say that I did nothing or that I did no work, but I just mean it's sort of, yeah. And so I guess the challenge, and then finding yourself in another place that you don't understand as well, or don't, maybe even don't like as well, that was certainly the case
when I
first arrived here.
Yeah.
You have to find the things in that new place that also inspire you. And yes, of course, there were many things here that could inspire me as well. You know,
Some way you have to recreate yourself again. You reborn.
Yes.
You kept some of the things that you feel that you want to keep with you, and you start new experience, new challenge, and you become some other person.
Yes.
In some ways. And I think that is a reborn. It's a beautiful experience. In some way, it's something that I call multiply by two.
Mm-hmm.
It's you multiply by two, because it's the Italian guy from New York and the Italian guy from Northwest. Wonderful. Okay,
yes.
Keep going.
Okay.
It's nice to know the story about the behind the poem. I like that very much.
Okay, here's a very recent poem. It's called In Your Arms. The morning after our nation fell, you held me as I wept and proclaimed me to be pure goodness. And that was so generous, because we both know that I have broken your heart more than once. So I don't deserve the appellation, but your love and your devotion are enough to make me want to live up to it.
Mm. Yeah, we were, no doubt, that was after what happened.
After the election, yes.
Yes. So it's, bueno, politics also surround art.
Yes, and then really, I believe that this expression from the 60s, the personal is political, is so true. I also think that all poems are political, because if your writing happens to be about human beings and the things that happen between them and among them, that's political, or there's no, you know, removing politics from that. So I think we all can start with where we are, internally and also physically, geographically, and that we will be writing political poetry, even if that's not our goal,
even,
you know, consciously.
If it's not our intention.
Not our intention, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
I completely agree. I think that everything we do is political, because first we have to make a decision. So there is a value there and a belief.
Yes.
And that is political.
Yes.
It's not that, oh, I don't believe in anything. We all believe in something or someone.
Yes. Yes, and everything in this poem that I just shared with you,
yeah,
is incredibly uncomfortable for me to share. But I also feel like it's my obligation. I feel like the artists who inspired me, the ones who really excite me, are people who talk about what they need to talk about without fear. So this would be an example of me writing about something that's very fearful for me. I mean, there are things in there that I don't want to admit out loud, even if we were just having a private conversation.
Yeah.
So I push myself to include those kinds of things in my poetry, because I believe that all of the best art has some element of that, some element of being candid in a way that we aren't always in our lives. One of the things that Allen Ginsberg said was, candor ends paranoia. So in the most recent book that I've written, I have that quotation at the beginning.
Yeah.
And when I was approached by this press, it's a Portland press called Lightship Press, like a lot of poetry presses, a two-person labor of love, Igor Brezhnev and Sam Rose Preminger. And all I was told was to try to think of some kind of a theme. And at that time period in my life, I was leading poetry workshops and memoir workshops, and thinking a lot about the overlap between the genres. And I had already had a belief that all of the writing genres overlap with each other, but trying to teach in two different genres really made me see how they all overlap. Poems are more and less autobiographical than people think they are. And in memoir, a certain amount of what you're doing when you write memoir is fiction. Because we are not all walking around with tape recorders or video recorders to document every second. So much of the writing in memoir or other kinds of autobiographical writing is doing the best that you can to recreate something, but it is essentially fiction. So I'm fascinated by the way that the different genres overlap, but I also believe in the concept of trying to be as candid as possible. So in that book, which is called Veracity, which has kind of a double meaning, I was trying to collect or find and collect the poems that I had written where I felt like I really was not wearing a mask as much as possible, or being as honest and candid as possible. And what I learned from the experience was that even when you are trying very hard to do that, it's still a mask. It's still a version of the self. You know, but I am one of those writers who is trying as hard as I can to be real at all times, you know, as much as I can.
And I can see that. I think it's very important to be, as you said, candid and honest, because this is the way how the reader will connect with you, yes, with your writing,
yes,
because they will feel that you're being honest and candid at the same time, and perhaps they will even understand how difficult it's for you to speak about something that is already difficult to even think about it.
I agree, and I talk to my writing students about this because I think that readers can also tell when you're holding something back. One of the things that I talk to the memoir writers about is that for me, this is just my personal preference, yeah, or interest as a reader, I like stories that are melancholy. And I think the reason is that if everything is happy in a story or everything is sad, I feel like the writer is being dishonest, or at the very least they're leaving something out that's very important. I feel like life is always a mix of happy and sad things, tragedy and also joy and so forth. So if a writer is really, it seems, avoiding one or the other of those things, I get suspicious. And maybe in some cases, not always, I get a little less interested in the writing because I feel like, oh, well, this person has decided they're going to leave a big chunk of their self or the story that they have to tell out of the story. And I'll probably move on to somebody else that I feel is being more candid than that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that looked like a mask. And reader, I think most of the time, identify that. Mm-hmm. They can perceive that there's something that is not working here. It doesn't, no. And we look for, we know for sure that some part is already fiction, yeah? Mm-hmm. Because the way how we, our memory works, mm-hmm, is not exactly the same way how we write the story. And also, many of the events that happen to us, it is important how we interpret those events. And after many years, we interpret completely different and yes, when they happen.
Yes.
And this is what is wonderful, I think, because this way you are showing how much you have been growing and how life has been helping you to become a better person.
Yes. Well, and the paradox of what we're talking about is that I feel like a writer is also obligated to themselves to change things about reality, in order to serve the poem or serve the story. So it's a paradoxical kind of a thing where you are trying to be candid and honest, and at the same time you're trying to decide what would best serve the feeling that I'm going for here. And that does not always line up with what would be the most accurate way of telling the story. We always have license to make things up. Even in autobiographical works, we always have license to improve upon reality if that's what really would make the story or the poem better. And so, yeah, it kind of sounds like I'm saying two things at the same time, but I really feel like all storytelling combines these different elements.
Yeah, talking about a biography, I read when I was younger the biography by Simone de Beauvoir, the three volume that she wrote, and at the end of the third volume, she said, "I didn't say everything. I was so disturbed because I was younger, and I thought, how could you say that you didn't write everything? You didn't tell us everything." But I was in my 18 years old at the time. And then later in my life, I always remember that sentence and I thought, how wise you were. You didn't need mm-hmm. to tell us everything. It was mm-hmm. enough what you said.
Well, and some writers, especially poets, because many poems use the personal pronoun I,
yes,
will in community fall into the trap of explaining poems or telling their audience or their friends or fellow writers which parts are true and which aren't. I'm not sure if that's interesting or important, you know? And so when I get to know these writers in the workshops, I remind them, because sometimes it's not intentional, but sometimes people have natural questions about which parts are true and which aren't. It's natural for them to have that question, but it's important for writers to remember they're not obligated to answer personal questions just because you talked about something very personal in a poem.
as a reader, we like to connect.
Yes.
So we ask that question, is this came out of experience when you lose your father or when you were abandoned by your husband or this and that? And you can say yes or no. And it's because we want to connect with the story and with the writer, because that is the reason in the first place we read biography and memoir.
Yes.
It's one way that we can become so-called friend in some ways.
Yeah, we know them and we don't know them at the same time.
Claro.
Yeah.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I think because I was mentioning it, I should read something from Veracity for you.
Okay, very good.
So this was something where my editor, Sam Preminger, on the book, they questioned my use of the word mask, which was one of the words in the book that I thought would be the easiest thing for people to remember. And then even though I had promised them, I will not be that kind of writer who is sending you new material while we're in the middle of doing this book, I made a liar out of myself and I wrote this poem for Sam, and I'd like to read it to you. My literal actual mask, with love and appreciation for my editor, Sam Preminger. Saintly equanimity, wide smile, to hide the pain inside. Big, wise beard to cover a double chin. Eyes of compassion, eyebrows raised at full attention, completely focused on you, interested in every word you utter. Long hair, because warriors wear it that way, and all of it topped off with a halo. Turn my mask inside out to find the skull that waits patiently for us all. Terror, sorrow, judgment, intolerance, mask and all teetering atop enormous belly, giant signal that I choose not to control my appetite. So one of the reasons that the book exists was I was trying to write about my relationship to, I'm overweight, I've been overweight most of my life, trying to write about what that is like and what some of the reasons, emotional reasons or psychological reasons might be. And I have to tell you that even though I take this very sort of candid, deep dive approach to things, that I don't really have the answer to that question, even after writing a bunch of poems about it. So I guess I'll have to keep writing poems about it and see if I can really, you know, figure that out. But several of the poems in the book are about sort of examining appetite, different ways that appetite manifests, and thinking about what are we trying to do when we do something like overeat or have emotional eating and so forth. And so I'm trying to use poetry to explore some of that.
Very brave of your part.
Yeah, and like I was saying before, it's very uncomfortable. I mean, it's not always, even when I read them in public, and even though I believe in reading things that make me uncomfortable in public, that doesn't mean that I'm always, you know, yeah, it makes me uncomfortable again. But I also kind of feel like if this is what we long for from our artists, if these are the things that when artists do them, they move us or they teach us, then I certainly can't, exempt myself from doing that. And so I also like the possibilities that are there in pushing yourself to go to places that are uncomfortable. It seems like the best material is in those places where, you know, so even in that self-interested way where we all want our stuff to be good, if you push yourself in this way, you're going to write better stuff than if you're sort of holding back.
I agree.
Yeah.
And we have been saying since the program started almost a year and a half ago, that words are tool to heal.
Yes.
And this is the way how we can get to know ourselves better, especially because we change with time. So if this has been something that bothers you and disturbs you and is an issue in you, let's figure out why. Yes. I think you have to, because it's one way that not only will improve and bring more element to your art and your craft, but also is something that you want to know.
Yes.
And that is what is important. And because here we are to please ourselves first.
Yeah.
It's not your editor or your family, it's you. And if you feel that this is important, you have to do it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And also, in the way how, look at Fellini or other Italian that you remind me very much, and Pavarotti, because you are a Pavarotti here. I am with Pavarotti.
I'm honored that you would use those names in the same sentence with,
of course, because
talking about me.
I admire both of them, and neither of them were thinner, you see? And so perhaps, I don't want to interfere, but I need to say that perhaps with this process that you are going through, it will come the truth, and finally you will say, this is who I am, period.
Yes.
And it's wonderful, and the people who care for me, love me, they will care, because this is who I am.
Yeah.
And that's it. And the whole thing, you close the door, but right now you are not there yet, but you're going there.
Right.
Or you change the situation, mm-hmm. or you accept it.
Yes.
And that is, I think, is very brave of your part, and I am very happy and honored that you are sharing this with us tonight.
Thank you.
And also that you're using in some way all the element that literature and your own creativity is giving you to overcome something that is for you an issue.
Yes.
We all have issues. I have my own, too.
Of course.
That is the reason, because I have a journal, so I write every mm-hmm. night. I try to. And to try to become a better person, a better woman, a better writer, a thing. And great. So go ahead. Keep going.
I just want to say one quick thing about healing, right?
Yeah.
And then I would love to read something else.
Go ahead.
I do think that journaling and doing creative writing can be a step in the healing process. I'm one of the poets who really believes that poetry saved my life. And there are many of us who say this, and I know that on the surface that may sound pretentious, or it may sound like a grand statement, but it's very literal for us. And there's a book that I can recommend. It's called Poetry as Survival. It was written by a person named Gregory Orr. And Gregory Orr is a great poet, great American poet, who also accidentally shot his brother to death in a hunting accident when he was younger.
Oh.
So it's very literal for Gregory. But what's great about this book for people who are going through their own tragedies and is how specific he gets about how lyric poetry and personal poetry can help us, and how we can learn and grow from it. And I really like that in the book he includes complete poems. Most of the time you're getting the whole poem that he's talking about rather than an excerpt. So I can't recommend that book highly enough. And I don't think that it's an overstatement of any kind to say that poetry can save us.
I agree completely. I mean, art for me is the most important aspect of life. What? Okay. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Consuelo.
Oh, you.
How are you?
Oh, my dear. I was just talking with Christopher about you before.
Christopher.
Yes, before I started the program. Oh, how nice. I have been thinking about you. How are you?
Me too. That's why I tuned in. Your show is always fantastic. I'm just so glad that, you know, that it's on, you know. Wonderful.
It's on.
This is a great time for your show, by the way. 7 p.m. on a Friday. I mean, it's perfect.
Yes, yes.
Well, anyway, I'm Ender.
I know.
Hello.
So glad to, for the listener, so glad to be part of this. Anyway, Once Upon a Time is fantastic, and I just have a question that is kind of a trick question, maybe. I don't know. But it's like, to both of you, and if possible, I would like both of you to answer.
Okay.
Like, why do you think that it's important to open up and look within and express oneself through words?
Christopher will answer first.
Okay.
Wow. I mean, this is the thing that I think about obsessively and talk about all the time. But you're really making me think of why is it important to do that? I feel like writing is an exploratory process. I think sometimes people who haven't tried to write yet might imagine that writers have written everything already in their heads and then they're just kind of transcribing. But actually the reason for writing is to explore the self and to learn things about yourself. And so you may sit down to feeling that you are writing on a particular topic or writing about to tell a particular story. And then through the process of the mind relaxing as you begin to tell the story, and this is why journaling is so helpful and important, you find yourself writing about or talking about entirely different things that may have even been at the subconscious level, but that were really aching and yearning to come out of you. And so, you know, I write to understand myself and the universe, and it's a very reliable way of doing that. And the question of whether what you've written as you are exploring yourself and trying to understand these things is good or not is a question that's almost completely unanswerable. So I say to my writers in my workshops, just keep going, you know, keep working. And I don't know that we get to decide whether the stuff is good or not. I think we know if we have done the best that we can do at this point in our writing lives, but I don't know if we ever really know the answer to the question of whether it was good or not.
I think what is if it's good enough or no doesn't matter. What is important is how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And like Christopher said, is one way how can you discover and explore yourself, because this is what we need to explore, not to we are not a fixed person. We are changing all the time, and there's something from our past or our present that we need to confront. And one way to do it is through the art, the music, composing a nice song that I hope you are doing it, and also a poem or a fiction or whatever way. Even when I cook, I feel that I am doing some kind of memoir, because I am thinking about all the time I cook with my mother or with the maid that she had. And so indeed, I believe strongly that it's a good exercise. It's almost the same that to pray. Why we pray? Because it's the word, and the word are healthy, and it helps us to see, okay, to look at us with some level of compassion. We need to look at ourselves with compassion and empathy. And also the word help that process, because sometimes we are so judgmental with ourselves, and so we hurt ourselves more than others sometimes. So if we have a journal or we write a story or whatever way that you express yourself, is one way to learn who you are, who you were, and how you are resolving some issue that they were or they are difficult for you. We all have issues. It's not that easy. It's hard, but we have the courage to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for the audience, for the reader or the listener, what it does for them is, when you share publicly the things that you've written, they begin to realize that they're not alone in the things that they're going through.
Yeah, that is a reason because I like biography, like I told you before, Christopher, because I think it's one way that I can learn from others, especially women, how they resolve the problem of self-doubt, censorship, and everything that we go through. And also how they resolve daily life. I mean, a relationship with a partner, children, parents. We all have problems. We human are complex. Yes. And we have to recognize and accept that complexity, and we have to learn how to take that complexity in our favor.
I agree.
What do you think?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Okay.
You.
I hope you call me again, but at home, so this way we have lunch and a dinner.
Keep up the great show. I have to say out loud, Once Upon a Time is my favorite show at KABU.
Okay.
So keep it
Thank
up.
You. Thank it's you very much.
Deal.
You have a
love you, Consuelo.
Me too, very much, my dear. I miss you terribly.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Bye. Got you later.
Behave, right. Behave.
I don't know about that.
Okay, I am going to...
Bye,
my dear.
Thank you.
I am going to remind you that we are in a much adventure, dollar for dollar, up to $20,000. So let's do it. Let's collaborate with this wonderful station, like I said when I started the show. And this way we can keep having guests like our wonderful Christopher that has been enlightening us with all kind of profound and deep thought and experience. Okay, go
That's
ahead.
That's very sweet.
No, it's true.
So I want to read something that has to do with community. And, you know, Allen Ginsberg, even though he became famous very young, he spent a lot of his life promoting and helping other poets and bringing attention to their work. So because he is the person that really made me want to be a poet, I've done a lot of community building through the Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic and the other things that I do. And I really believe in this way that art can help us build community. And that's what KBOO does also, right?
Yes.
So here's a poem.
This program.
Yes.
This program.
Because I'm in this role of helping other people find their way to their creativity or their belief in self, I end up writing about these things a lot. So here's a poem. And the title of the poem comes from, it's a quotation from David Meltzer. Poetry is music that attempts to be song. Poetry's a magic act. David Meltzer, Two-Way Mirror, A Poetry Notebook. I cannot remember a time when my troubled mind was not filled with questions. There is no end to the mysteries one might worry or wonder about, and the universe so vast. Therefore, it was a blessing to discover Whitman and Ginsberg that summer in my 20s, after my first failure, picking up credits in the humanities to complete a BS degree. I felt just like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, floating aimlessly in his parents' swimming pool while commuting out to St. Joseph's with Astral Weeks on the tape deck, blissful to be tortured by Amy's thigh-high stockings during our dissection of The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Leaves of Grass and Allen's collected poems blew my young mind so completely that the magic in those pages determined the course of my life. The vibrancy contained in the words and phrases of each high-energy construct in those weighty tomes pulled me by the lapels into the future to place me here at the table, babbling like a madman about minute particulars and negative capability, poems that kill and poetry as survival. My vocation, a reliable method of divination, a path to the truth, or at least a way to summon the courage to spend eternity posing the proper questions.
That is exactly the key of the issue, asking the proper question.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we shouldn't be afraid, even if it's painful. And we cry the whole day or a whole week or a whole month. And also another thing, thinking about the question by Ender, is it's time to listen our voice. We all have a voice, internal voice.
Yes.
And it's important what kind of thing are we telling us, yeah? Because some of them are hurtful, others are not so much. But listen to the child we were. Mm-hmm. It's important to bring that child to our present life and to protect that child. And I tell my little Consuelo, when she is scared, I said, I am here to protect you. Don't worry. I am here for you. You trust me. And when I feel that she is with me and she reverse role, I think, mm-hmm. is wonderful, because in some way we live together. We are one.
Yes.
What do you think?
I think, well, listening to you, what made me think about is how important intuition is. And I love thinking about the certain things where if you use them, it will make your life better, but also make your writing better. And intuition is a great example of that. If you listen to your intuition and trust it, you make better decisions in life. You're less likely to make big mistakes in your life because you're listening to that inner voice. When you're going through the creative process and often doubting yourself, often wondering about whether what you have to say or how you're saying it is okay or not, or whether you like it or not, it really helps to listen to that inner voice that we all have and trust it. So along with the belief in self that I'm hoping that, you know, the writers and creative people that I work with will begin to develop and trust in, you know, trusting in your own inner voice is very important. It's hard to go wrong when you really do trust that. And that thing I was talking about earlier where you, even if you're very inexperienced, that you believe that you as an individual are interesting, and that your particular way of telling stories is also unique and interesting. You can really coast on that for a long time before you've gathered all of the skills that you will need to gather to do things in a more intentional way.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be adventure also.
Yes.
It's not the final product what is important, it's the process.
Absolutely.
How we get from here to there. And when I have had a very tough time in my life, always was the question was how I get from A to B, because it seemed that I will not be able to get to B. Mm-hmm. But with work, with discipline, with some people who care for me, I was able, you see. And we all have some people who care for us. We are not that alone now.
Right, right.
And we have to protect ourselves. Okay, another point, please.
Okay.
I like that very much about community. I think art and community goes together.
Okay.
It's only one thing, art and community.
So one of my books that I brought along is Exchanging Wisdom, A Guide for Parents of the Autonomous. This is the first and only book so far that I've collaborated on with my son, Angelo. So it's about our relationship.
So you will read a poem by him or by you first? Because I would like you to read a poem by him too. You can do that later.
I can do that. Okay. That's going to be strange since it's him writing about his father, but I can do that if that's what you want.
So this way we compare and contrast.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So this is called, this is an excerpt from a longer piece called Ode to Kathleen Luna, that's my mother, the OG, or original goddess, Mother's Day 2009. When I was a teen, if you saw me scribbling in one of my notebooks, you'd jokingly ask if I was writing about how wonderful my mother is. I confess that this was not always the case. However, I wrote with the awareness that none of the adventures I was having would have been possible without you. I occasionally ask Angelo to promise me that he will remain sweet forever. There isn't enough sweetness in the world, I tell him, so you'll be doing a good thing if you hold on to that. When he throws his arms around me, tells me, I love you, you're the best dad in the world, or brings me flowers, I am filled with an indescribable joy and the knowledge that he is a living embodiment of the love you created, a love which will outlive us all. And I can tell you that my mother's mind was fairly blown by me describing her as a goddess.
I think
I'm the only person who's ever used that word to describe her in her life. So, but, you know, this is sometimes, I guess, one of the superpowers of poets, right, is to be able to pay tribute to the important people in our lives, right?
So, I think it's a must.
So the majority of the poems in here were written by me, but I'm going to try to find one that he wrote that hopefully will be short enough that we can share it here. Let me see.
And
most of his are towards
the
end.
We will have him in February or March here. He will come and he will read his own poem.
Okay.
Or maybe they will come together, so that will be very interesting to have a father and son.
Okay, so I'm going to read this one because when he reads it, I cry. So I don't know if I'll be able to read this without crying, but it's... Like everything in here, most of the poems that Angelo wrote that are in the book are things he wrote for my birthday or Father's Day, you know, so.
If you cry, I cry with you, so don't worry.
Okay, thank you for having my back.
Yes.
It's called Atta by Angelo Luna. Not a beat poet, but loves the beat, certainly. Smooth jazz, rapid rhythms, the claws that sink in when an invader grabs you by the short and curlies and tells you to dance. Not a beat poet, no. But described by Ginsberg decades before his existence nonetheless. First thought, best thought, uninhibited, uncontrolled, a radioactive substance in writing. Internal radiation therapy, words healing the country from the inside out. While the world burns in Trump's America, Bolsonaro's Brazil, God's earth, he writes his truth and fights fire by sucking the oxygen out of the room. A man whose quantifiable praise for his ancestors quiets crowds when it's spoken out loud. No more fire. There aren't enough of him. Not quite Zen, but Buddhist in soul and practice. Does what's being said need to be said? Why are you saying it? Does it help anyone? They may be mantras to some, but it's better thought of as a scientific method. Dissect every interaction, future and past, and see which parts were necessary. Make yourself the best you can be. I write inhibited, clinical, still coming into my own and learning from my betters. He teaches as a delimiter, not a time bomb, not a beat poet definitively, but heavily influenced and proud of it. Surrealist, grounded, visionary works clutter file cabinets, real and digital. Ginsberg watches him from another life, passing by on the street every chance he gets without knowing it. I like to think that if reincarnation is real, the way things go, that if reincarnation is the way things go, that good old Alan is younger than my father. Maybe he's a student, a fellow teacher, a preteen he makes a collage for. Maybe he's me, though I doubt it. I have other elders to follow. Stoic principles prepare us for loss, and I'll spend my time in study preparing for his most. Regardless of the sum of my works or the product of his, I don't know what real life will do when he's gone. A crack in an invisible wall that only suffers when a truly great person leaves. There's only so many it can take. I often wonder if his will be the last. He betters himself, works with his son to live longer, even though it hurts, and sometimes isn't as entertaining as others. He doesn't want to see that wall crack either. He wants to surpass legacies, become one of those elders. No, that's incorrect. Forgive my candidness, but that's what I want. He would be happy leaving a mark on a closed small circle. I want to see his name in essays 50 years from now. Either way, I'll be proud. He deserves it. So I made it through, but it was tough.
Yeah, how nice a relationship between the two of you.
We do have a good relationship. And part of it, one of the themes of the book, I guess, is that I understood that the parent-child relationship is inherently fascist. And the only way to get away from that is to really allow and understand that it's okay and it should be the case for even children to be autonomous individuals. So as long as Angelo, when he was a small child, as long as he wasn't hurting himself or hurting somebody else, I allowed him to find his way in the world, and I trusted him to be smart enough to be able to do that without my help. And it's really hard as a parent sometimes not to jump in every second at every little thing that happens. But I really feel like what resulted was an autonomous individual with a mind of his own who trusts in his own ability to take responsibility for himself and make the right decision.
You know? How wise of your part. I had completely opposite experience. Yeah. Very overprotected all the time, all mm-hmm. the time, until I decide 25 to leave my parent home. And that gave me some strain, but took a lot of my self-esteem down too, because it's what you have done for him, I think, is the right way to educate a child to become independent, to think by themselves, and to create their own mm-hmm. who they want to become.
Yeah. Well, we can't control other people, and I don't have a desire to control other people. We can only sort of control what we do.
Yes.
And so I decided to raise my son in a certain way, and I decided to run the Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic in a certain way. And that's how you demonstrate to people that there are other ways of doing things by, you know, by trying something different and not having it be a disaster as a result.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's, well, not all the parents have the same philosophy or the same bravery to allow their children to go their own way. Okay, we are almost finishing our program, but I would like to the last poem. Have one?
I think so. And I think I can. Yes. I think I have something ready for you that's kind of short.
Do you have a website? Do you have where we can read?
Yeah, you can look at ChristopherLunaPoetry.com and also PrintedMatterVancouver.com.
Okay, very
Thank
good.
You. So this is from the book Veracity, and it's called Still Passing Notes. I receive daily email dispatches from Barbara Lynn in New York City. My lifeline since 1986. My best friend since she sat down at the desk in front of me in English class on her first day at Longwood High School. All these years later, she is still showing me and many others how to be human, sharing a quotation from Zen sage Alan Watts. No amount of anxiety makes any difference to anything that is going to happen. Oh, how I'd love to hear you breathe, connected yet separated, the distance between us, safety or danger, depending upon the context, which is perilously invisible, temporarily, or so we are promised, to encourage calm among the populace. We have always been in the midst of this existential crisis, just not at the same time.
Nice. Okay, we're almost finishing. It went fast, isn't it? Yeah, we had a great conversation as often. And I would like to invite you to the second Friday of January. Maura will be with us. And she is an American Irish woman, also very brave, like Christopher. And she wrote her biography, memoirs, that she called, where she tell us about her life as an Irish girl and in a convent. So that is going to be a very interesting conversation. I hope to have you here the Friday, second Friday of January. Good holiday and happy new year with many, many joy and nice project and traveling and having fun and being a better person. Thank you very much. And until next year, and here we have some music.
With a finger down the road so dark and narrow in the evening, just before the sun is six bells chime. It all the doctor barking. Way out on the damp and studded highway where you wander. And you roam from your retreat and view. Over on the railroad.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
I'm way, born to Yorkshire, because you're in Yorkshire.